Welcome to Irish Illustrated Insider, the Blue Gold Game Preview Edition. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated and John Bryce of USA Today. We are 2 days away, about 49 hours from the start of the 95th annual Blue Gold Game, 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon Eastern Time in South Bend, Indiana, which means the 2031 edition is going to be a lot of fun, guys. That'll be number 100. But first, we are going to talk about this one. And also, John Bryce just mentioned off of the air that it was National Jelly Bean Day yesterday. I'm a big fan of those. Today is actually National Talk Like Shakespeare Day. If Tim Priester, if you want to do that a little bit, when you give us your review of new Notre Dame commit John Gay, and we will get, of course, to the decommit of Khalil Terry as well.
I think he's a real solid player. I think it's kind of hard for me to talk about John Gay without bringing up Khalil Terry, because there's a correlation there. And I think Notre Dame, for lack of a better way of saying it, chose the one that's the better fit for Notre Dame. Now, don't get me wrong. I thought Khalil Terry will knock you into next week, man. Really, really physical football player. So I thought that was a loss in terms of, you know, on-field ability. But, you know, John Gay, I think he's a combination of a guy that is strong on run support. I think he's an in-the-box. He's a nickel or in-the-box safety. But he can also turn and run with some fast receivers. So I think the combination of those two, plus he obviously, when he came to campus last weekend, really impressed Notre Dame, and Notre Dame jumped on the opportunity. So certainly a loss of Khalil Terry. I'm not in the camp of, you know, when a guy decommits, it's not that big of a deal anyway. It was. He's a powerful hitter, but I think the combination of everything with John Gay is going to work out well. I like him at nickel. He's listed as a safety. I would imagine he can play safety, but the film that we see of him in the box defending the pass as well as supporting the run, I think is really, really impressive.
Yeah, I think
go ahead, JB.
I was just going to say, I think he's a natural fit. I know this staff is incredibly high on him. Talked with some people on campus earlier this week when it seemed that this move was imminent. They believe there's a tremendous amount of upside there. And it's another guy that they really like his physical features, the length and things that he brings to the table in that regard.
You know, when you lose one and get one, but the one you lost knew you were recruiting multiples anyway. They did want both, as Priester, you're kind of pointing out. It's not choosing one or the other. You have to choose one or the other now because he only got one of the two. I asked three people that I thought would very much know, because we got a question actually directly on it. From Maltese Irish, which of the following to believe was the biggest factor in Khalil Terry's decommitment? And none of them would give a biggest factor. They all said confluence of events, kind of this is what happens. The options were position coaching change, yes. Desire to stay out west, yes. The Irish recruiting another safety, yes. But they always plan on recruiting another safety. So as usual, what do we say? It's more than one thing, right? Because that's usually what it is. And that's, you know, when you recruited this level of safeties, I guess we're in a new world where this is not a Mickens commit, but I liked his film too, Priester. I made sure I jumped in because it wasn't a Mickens commit, and I wanted to see what you're looking for. And honestly, it won't be about John Gay, but we have a nickel question later that makes this a very important get, because you do have to recruit nickels these days. This is not safeties and corners. There's guys that can just be better at the starting position. That used to be a linebacker of nickel.
Who is it? Terry Benedict asked the question in the second segment about that. And I think it's a very good one, that it's a very specialized ability. You know, at corner, you can drop and you have time to adjust to the route as a defender. There's very little time to adjust to anything when you're pressing at the line of scrimmage on a guy lined up in the slot. So I may be stepping over to the question in segment two, but yeah, it's very specialized. It's very difficult to do. And I really like the way that John Gay plays the pass, but also again, very, very aggressive and not as physical as Terry. I think Khalil Terry's really, really physical, but a guy that can definitely support the run as well.
There is a NFL draft tonight, guys. We talked a little bit about it on Monday. Let's just get into, I think, the thing that every Notre Dame fan will know by Monday. Not where everybody goes in the third, fourth, fifth, seventh, and free agency rounds, but where Jeremiah Love ends up in this draft, because he could be one of the higher picks in recent memory, and if Jadarian Price can sneak into that spot in the first round. Because, John Bryce, when you sneak into a first-round spot, you usually go into a much better spot than when you're one of the highest draft picks in Notre Dame history.
Now, there's no question, and obviously the Seattle Seahawks lost their running back Kenneth Walker to the Kansas City Chiefs in the offseason. Talked to an agent in New York yesterday or Tuesday. The days run together as I'm traveling this week. But he did not think that Jeremiah Love would dip below the number five spot. He wasn't as sold on the Arizona Cardinals at number three, but he felt very strongly that there was zero chance, his words, not mine.
Man, JB Dip. I would say he's in the LaPorte area, which always knocks all my sword when I go back and forth.
Pulled off the chart. If a team just go with a running back late, then Jadarian Price is the guy, and he's done nothing but assist to help his stock with his workouts and his meetings.
Priester, I don't know if you have an opinion of where he'll go. I just have a guess that he will go into the early second round.
Well, I think, like we put in our staff picks, I think they're staff guesses.
Yes.
You know, pretty much.
I agree.
But you know, I think all along we've talked about Tennessee Titans, and I just don't, now that it's D-Day, I don't think he's going to go there. I think he's going to go number five to the Giants. I agree that he doesn't slip past number five. You know, I mean, the Titans would be a good fit. You've got your quarterback of the present and future, and there's your running back. But I just don't think the Titans are going to go in that direction. My prediction / guess at this point is it's going to be the Giants at number five.
Yeah, Joe Alton's number five. Ronnie Stanley and Quentin Nelson were number six in recent drafts. So Jeremiah Love would join that select group. As you know, my feeling, just don't end up on the Rams or something like that, where I have to watch and root against Jeremiah Love two times a year, because that's the selfish world we live in now with Love. That is, there's not a lot of guys that I just like. Kyren Williams hurt a little, but in five rounds, that's everybody's fault, right? They all made that mistake that they didn't pick up Kyren Williams. I just want to be able to root openly for Jeremiah Love, because as we have been on the Jeremiah Love train for a very long time. Priester, I'm glad you said that. These were staff guesses. We usually have staff projections. It was staff guesses when it came to where those guys are going to go. I'm rooting for Jadarian Price to go as the number two back, because it's not incredible that this has never happened before, but it would be a great story for Notre Dame. You've never had the first and second running back drafted in an NFL draft from the same school. I say it's not incredible because that was an impossibility about 25 years ago, right? Yeah. You're not going to have that. That's when the bell cow running back was the thing here. But boy, it'll be awesome for Notre Dame. Before we get to the blue gold game, there's been a little bit of extra news. Some playoff talk, 2014 playoff talk has heightened a bit. Heather Dinich reported that Notre Dame's stance on the matter has softened a little bit. We know Pete Bavakwa said back in December, I think it was, that 16 was the way to go. It still sounds like he believes 16 is the way to go. It's just there's at some point you have to open yourself up to what might happen if there's 24. Other than too many teams, Tim Priester, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, my first thought is, or my first comment is, just like when they expanded to 12, has anybody asked the players what they think about this? And maybe, yeah. How does this work out? Are there eight byes? If you have 24, do eight teams get a bye and the other 16 teams play and eliminate half of that group? I'm not really sure how that works. I think 24 is too many and kind of a waste of time, because it's not going to – the national champ is not going to come out of the number 17 spot or the number 19 spot. It's not basketball. It's football. And we have a question here that you inserted there, yeah. T.O., from Irish Murph. Let me go ahead and read it, and I want to respond to that. Has Notre Dame's stance on playoff expansion changed? Listening to a national college football podcast, it was said Pete Bavakwa was on the side of 24 teams, but he stated he felt 16 was the way to go when asked in December. I don't think he said he was on the side of it. He said he was open to it, but I think that he's just trying to, you know, maybe fit with the rest of the crowd a little bit, or not be the squeaky wheel in that whole process. But 16 teams, I think, is what makes the most sense. First round buys, we've seen in recent years that doesn't really work very well for the teams that get the buy. So I like the number 16 and just go ahead and play it out. Everybody plays the same amount of games and you go for it from there.
JB, since every hill is a hill to die on, why don't you chime in on what hill you're going to die on here and your actual thoughts on the process?
Yeah, I'm very staunchly in the 12 to 16 team field, but it absolutely is not going to matter. I actually just left the office of new first-year University of Kentucky head coach Will Stein. My last question to him literally was, where do you fall on this? The debate's going on right now. And he said, there's no question. I'm 24. I believe in the 24-team system. If we get a 24-team system, there are probably about 8 SEC teams getting in the playoffs in some years. And he's not the first person to tell me that. I spoke with another chief of staff of an SEC program during my travels this week who said, I don't like 24, but I think it's inevitable. That's where we're going. I talked with some other people over the course of this week and last week when I was chasing down the 5-for-5 talk and the potential for playoff expansion. The key now is that the SEC coaches are being vocal about favoring 24, and Greg Sankey is the one who had sort of dug in and tried to make it a standoff between 16 and 24. And now you've got a number of SEC coaches who have openly gone on the record and said they want 24. The Big Ten has already been on the record wanting 24. So I think 24 is inevitable. I was told 24 by 27 is a real possibility. That's where things are. What it will do, TP, to your point, I was told it would absolutely be the death knell of conference championship games. And yeah, inevitably it will be the end of those. And you would have more of those teams. I haven't seen the potential playoff bracket. I haven't seen the proposal, but Will Stein made it clear to me today that in that scenario, you would have more home games on campuses. And there might still be a bye in some way, shape, or form, TP, but the bye would not last as long. You wouldn't have 4 weeks off before your first game or 3.5 weeks off before your first game. You might have 2 weeks off before your first game.
That'd be good. Yeah, with the elimination of the conference championship games, which I think are cool. I mean, I think we've all enjoyed that you know, week of competition. But if you're going to expand like this, you just can't keep playing that game. And the problem that we ran into last year is there are no consequences then for losing a conference championship game. And that's not what football should be about at that time of the year.
You know the real reason they should get rid of conference championship games, though? Jack Freeman does. Because conferences are dumb. There's a blue gold game coming up, guys. It is Saturday, and it's going to matter a lot in our ecosystem for 10 days. And it's going to matter a lot for people that like to watch the blue gold game all summer. For 3 months, at that point, I have completely given up on the blue gold game and it meaning anything. But for 10 days, the blue gold game and the jersey scrimmage are what we have before we can collect some intel on what's going on in the summer. There are more storylines to watch because last year I felt like it was the quarterbacks was the storyline to watch. We felt like we knew everything about the quarterback situation. We were proven somewhat right and somewhat wrong. Kenny Minchie went from way out of it to right in it and kind of probably helped send Steve Angeli to Syracuse because if Steve Angeli was the clear number 1B, he could have stayed at Notre Dame. This year, no such drama. I guess the only news about quarterbacks is Ian Book will join Tony Simeone as the play-by-play announcer. I put in Monday Musings that Ian was going to do this, so he broke the news there. He was great. If you didn't get to see it, he was great on Notre Dame's Pro Day.
He was great. He
really different world, of course, but that was a great way to break himself in, too. And let's start with Kay Beasley, whose question is, what midseason enrollees besides Rodney Dunham do you think should or might flash during the Blue Gold game? And I'll preface this, Tim Priester, by telling you there are 24 others to choose from. So yeah. Some good flash.
Well, I, you know, kind of following up on something that Sampson said a while back about opportunities for, you know, for running backs, Jonas Walton, I think, is in a position to get a bunch of carries on Saturday. Look, first of all, and I think this is the way you guys look at it, but this is the jersey scrimmage is more of a team setting and the blue gold game is more of an individual setting. So like if you're looking for offensive line cohesion, that was last week. It's not going to be
all mixed up
necessarily this week. So it, for me, it's all about individual play when it comes to this. So, you know, I think there's no reason why Devin Fitzgerald shouldn't continue to flash as he has throughout the spring. A guy like Bubba Frazier, I think this is kind of tailor-made for him to have a day. What does that mean? 3 receptions, maybe 4 receptions, something along those lines. And Joey O'Brien, who flashed last week at safety in the jersey scrimmage as well, could be a guy that you see stand out individually.
Yeah, I like Walton. I like Frazier a lot. Also, I frankly think because the spring has been so freaking competitive, and again, we saw it last Saturday, continues to be driven home to me pretty much anytime I talk to someone from campus. The Notre Dame secondary, especially that first unit, is so good. that no one has really seen CJ with the chance to air it out. So maybe CJ Carr gets a chance to just go deep in the blue and gold game because of the way the rosters are constructed or something along those lines. It's a chance for Spencer Porath to kick in the stadium. We heard Marcus Freeman say he was, what, 9 for 9 last Saturday? I think it was actually maybe 11 for 11. And I know that he has hit from beyond 50 yards over the course of this spring camp. So maybe this is a day that, Spencer Porath shines kicking it actually in Notre Dame Stadium. Similarly, on Scaife, I think that, again, I'm a special teams guy, but I think that, Scaife will boom some on Saturday in there. And then big on Koakia. I expect Koakia to flash on Saturday, absolutely, on the defensive side of the ball. And I would say Iwatade in addition to Dunham.
Who do you have, Tim?
Yeah, I admit I really like watching the young players for the Blue Gold game. Doesn't necessarily tell you they're gonna have a great season, but those are the guys to focus on, because you got to get the other guys out of there, quite frankly. The guys like Jalen Snead and Jaden Osbury, who I'm still curious about, you got to get them out. Iwatade and O'Brien top my list. I want to watch Pouncey hopefully against some ones, because they won't be in there long, but it'd be great to see him against some ones. I feel like I didn't get enough to see enough of him in the jersey scrimmage, Jaden Pouncey, so I'd like to see Pouncey. Grubbs is, of course, going to be a star in this. If Hebert's still bothered by a knee injury, Grubbs is going to have a heck of a lot of time playing quarterback, because now you can let CJ Carr throw a fair amount, though. You're not going to touch him. So it's not like CJ Carr has to come out of this game. He would have to get hurt accidentally, like hitting his hand on a helmet or something along those lines. But Grubbs is one I really want to watch. In terms of veterans, I just wish guys like, we have questions on him, Quincy Porter could play. I'd like to see him in there. I assume you're going to get Mylon Graham out quickly. So maybe see that Micah Gilbert and even Cam Williams situation. I like to see Cam Williams go against someone of at least Pouncey's level. And if he's making a play against Aiden Pouncey, then you kind of carry that into the offseason, thinking maybe he's taking a stride to be, because they're going to need a sixth and seventh guy. He's not taking the stride to be the fifth guy. But, you know, there's availability there, because when you can name six guys right now, Priester, one of them will definitely be lost to injury. So you need the seventh guy coming in.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think we're all Jalen Snead, I think we'd all like to see him just really put it all together this year. So if he pops out individually, I think that'd be a good sight to see, like maybe some type of specific role for him. You know, again, I don't think this is the kind of gathering where you glean a whole lot from the team play, but individually you'd like to see him playing with confidence and making some plays and flying around.
JB, before I go back to a final thought for you on the Blue Gold, because we have 9 questions on it, probably Keon Keeley. I would like to see Keon Keeley against a quality tackle, because there's been so many questions about him and we kind of embraced his interview. Now it's time to embrace his play on the field of play. And I want to caution everybody, Tim, you were with me on this. Javonte Jean-Baptiste didn't do a damn thing when we left the Blue Gold game, and he was the top 5-6 player on Notre Dame's football team the next
year. We had no idea that he would have the kind of season that he had in the fall based upon the spring.
Yeah, I would say also Javonte Jean-Baptiste certainly earned that and played at a level that none of us expected. He also had to play at a level that none of us expected, because the depth was different. So I would say go into it with an open awareness of Keon Keeley, that he is going to be a guy for Notre Dame this year. He is at no point going to be the guy for Notre Dame this year.
We'll be back with segment 2 and plenty of questions burning up the boards. Welcome back to segment 2, burning up the boards. Our first question is from KGarrity8. We are going to continue on a Blue Gold game theme for a moment here. For the sake of not getting too reactionary on different players or positional groups going into the Blue Gold game, give us one group or one player. We need to tamp our expectations a little bit, and also a group or a player we're not talking enough about.
I would, you know, a lot of people have been talking about Joey O'Brien, and Joey O'Brien stood out a little bit last Saturday. And I'm not saying that he's not going to be a good football player. I just don't know that physically he's ready for, you know, a significant role this fall. There are four safeties that are ahead of him, or, you know, elder statesmen compared to him. So I've just tamped it down. But again, you're looking for individual performance, and there's no reason why he can't have a good day. I know a lot of people got excited about Cam Williams based upon the clips that Notre Dame put out, and then the jersey scrimmage didn't work out really, really well for him. So I would throw that name out there, especially when you consider the competitive nature of the W position, you know, where Porter and Gilbert are aligned and Devin Fitzgerald's a candidate there as well. So those are two guys, one on each side of the ball, that I would say Tampa down. Maybe not talking enough about Kohakia. I know JB mentioned him. I would agree with that. Ethan Long is that fourth safety. I think he's in the process of becoming a really good football player. And I feel like we talk about this guy a lot, and it's like it isn't necessarily somebody that excites the masses out there, but the return of Cooper Flanagan is extremely significant to this offense, and I don't think that his value to the offense is talked about enough, other than me constantly saying it, and you, Tim, I think, saying it on a weekly basis.
I wonder if we'll see a skirmish on Saturday, since that's been that's been the most consistent part of the spring camp. And it's been a great spring camp, but they're like, and you just mentioned him, Cooper Flanagan, Adon Shuler, and Jalen Snead. Nobody has been at the epicenter of more skirmishes than those three. In terms of tamping down, I would just say tamp down on both lines, because when those guys laid it all out last Saturday, and this Saturday is much more of an exhibition, and things are just going to be different. You're in the stadium. The quarterbacks obviously are not at all live. I just think you'll see some guys flash. You want to see some flashes, especially from the D linemen. But I just won't read a lot personally into the performance of the lines on either side of the ball on Saturday.
That's a good point. I actually took this question as expectations beyond the blue goal game. But if you're going in the blue goal game, yeah, the hitting will not be as violent. Tim Priester, do you think Marcus Spoon will pull Lou Holtz and tell his team if they fight he's going to resign? I don't think that's the
point. I don't think that's no, times have changed, and the man at the top views things a lot differently.
You might tell them before the Miami game, if you don't fight, I will resign.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
And times have changed enough. In fairness to Lou Holtz, there was a bit of a situation going on, and he shouldn't have done it then, but I understand. If people don't understand why he would do such a thing, it was a pretty violent rivalry at that time. So, no, that won't happen. I hope he plays, because I feel like we've just put Dallas Golden out of sight, out of mind. The problem is he probably won't play if he was nursing any injury whatsoever. It's still undisclosed, right? We didn't end up asking Marcus Freeman about that.
No, he said lower back.
Lower back. Okay, then he probably won't play. Then he probably won't play. So a guy that I think, if our expectations are ridiculous, like they seem to be, since he was included in a question with Jeremiah Love, Jadarian Price, CJ Carr, and KVA, I mean, Will Black has some growing to do. I want to watch Will Black before I go ahead and anoint that the line's automatically better because they're going to another rookie at the left side. But I hate to ruin people's parties, but, you know, Will Black probably – here's the deal. Will Black will be a much better player in Game 16 this year and a way better player in Game 16 next year than he will be in September, even depending who he's going against. It's just the way it works. Next question, Irish from A2. What is the ceiling, speaking of expectations, for Rodney Dunham this season? Could he have a similar impact to freshman Stephon Tuitt or even Aaron Lynch? I threw in the even because they are different from freshman year.
Yeah. Go ahead, John.
I would say I would liken him more to potentially being able to have a Boubacar Traore type impact, maybe even probably more than Isaiah Foskey. But along the lines of Boubacar was impacting games. We saw Boubacar flash all camp long that year, but then he didn't flash immediately when the season started, but he still had some moments. So I do believe that he will be a factor this year for the defense, and that he will make a couple of plays this fall that just get people as excited about his future as what I think we all were when we saw Boubacar Traore literally almost be unblockable, especially in that school field practice a few years ago.
Yeah, I don't really know how to put him in context with Tuitt and Lynch. Tim, you'll do a better job of that than me. But I will say this. I do think he has a chance to be the third defensive end. I think Keon Keeley has to pick up the pace, and I think Logan Thomas needs to make, you know, some progress physically and put himself in a position. So comparing, I'm going to let you talk about that a little bit, Tim, because you'll be able to delve into exactly what those guys did during their initial season. But the number three defensive end, when you consider what we've seen and when you consider some of the things that Marcus Freeman said about him last Saturday, I think there's a very strong possibility he's your number three man in the rotation behind the two starters with Young and Traore.
I think it's really interesting what Drew Mentok said. It might have been Monday. Could have been when we were standing in the freezing cold, Tim, about to do instant analysis, that we don't treat Dunham like he's the number one five-star recruit on the team until the end of this jersey scrimmage. We're like, oh, yeah, he's still doing good stuff. It's like, right. If this was a different class, people be like, why isn't Rodney Dunham done enough? Because they didn't see any of practice. He is the number one recruit in the class. He's the five-star in the class at defensive end, and it seems like he was taken for granted. I did a very quick quote search on Google because I remember what Andrew Hendricks said in Aaron Lynch's first spring game. Aaron Lynch dominated the first spring game he played in as an early enrollee. Andrew Hendricks said, and I quote, "That's no high school out there. That's one big boy. We all know in the locker room, and now you're all going to find out. I have a couple bags of ice with his name on it today," because he was live. Lynch and Tuitt came into a 3-4, and they probably were the two of the three best defensive ends, but they had Ethan Johnson and Capron Lewis Moore, and they had a good defense that year that didn't play great. If he's anything like Aaron Lynch, Notre Dame, when I make those nice comments about playing 16 games, they're playing 16 games. Aaron Lynch, as a freshman, what, 8 tackles for loss, 6 sacks, 2 forced fumbles, and they sat him out the Michigan loss because they didn't think he could.
Didn't think he was ready to.
Yeah,
play consistent. You know, because
Ethan Johnson and Cap can contain Denard Robinson, but there's no way Aaron Lynch possible. So there was no.
Who knew?
Those guys were great, and then Tuitt became a great sophomore.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, I don't remember exactly how large they were, what their weight was. I just envisioned those guys as bigger guys, whereas Dunham's more of a sleek guy. You know, firing off the edge.
I think one good point here, and we'll let JB chime in. That's a great call, Tim, but it also goes to what Samson said. He goes, I just looked at Rodney Dunham, and years ago we'd think, my God, that guy's huge, and he just looks like a guy that's out there with other huge guys. I think it's Notre Dame's defensive ends that make Rodney Dunham look like a normal human, whereas Aaron Lynch looks like he was just a monster walking around out there.
I think that's true.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's what I touched on last week as to kind of why I think that, and certainly why I think that way about Keon Keeley is just the stature of that entire defensive line group, whether you're talking ends or interior players, changed so dramatically, both since Marcus Freeman took over the program and specifically year over year. And as much as we talk about the wide receivers group being improved and upgraded, I don't think physically there's a group on the team that looks more different or disparate from a year ago than the D-line.
Yeah, he was Tim Priester. Did a quick search: 6'6", 265 freshman.
Yeah, that's a good 25 pounds heavier than what Dunham is.
That's a big dude, man.
You know, and I haven't been down on the Drew Mentok's been down on the field, and he spoke, you know, about Iwatani's just overall physical presence more so than Dunham.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's an impressive. And I didn't expect that either, you know, with Iwatani coming out. I figured he was going to be a project weight-wise, but he really started to bridge the gap early in the process.
And if I recall, too, it was even bigger because he was really more of a defensive tackle, too.
Yeah.
Next question, Irish Flyer 96. Can you share insight into how Marcus Freeman runs his practices and maybe how it's evolved since he started as a head coach? JB, we will go to you.
It's something I've talked to Marcus about in the past, and he tries to evolve it every single year. I think he would tell you they're more efficient now. There's more, especially this year, because of the carryover on the all three coordinator positions. There's just greater consistency. There's greater familiarity. And so there seems to be a much better efficiency, as it's told to me. The other thing I would say is that Marcus Freeman has learned that not every day has to be a Bloody Tuesday, or not every day has to be fourth and one for a spot in the playoffs. Like, he has done a great job of getting the pulse of the team, the pulse of his program, and also trusting his assistant coaches to know that, to know the days when he will call them up and he will huddle them up early if he doesn't like what he sees, and he will kick their asses verbally. And then he knows the days that it will work itself out. And I think we've seen a lot of that this spring in terms of how the scuffles on the practice field have been managed, because you basically are seeing those guys allowed to fight, and then some teammates are expected to go in and break it up, and then the sidelines better not clear. And none of that's happening by accident, as it was explained to me. Like, there is a method to the madness as it pertains to the skirmishes and just the way that practice has evolved and been executed, especially this spring.
I agree with you, John. I mean, I think that it's an interesting evolution of, and we don't see practices very often, of course, but I think just an interesting evolution as Marcus Freeman has become accustomed to being a head coach. I mean, just think about his demeanor when his first year started. And I don't think he's afraid to throw a curveball into practice based upon what he feels the team needs at that moment. But that shouldn't surprise anybody, because Marcus Freeman is constantly seeking and searching for ways to challenge his team in different ways. This whole scuffle, you know, if they're not scuffling, they're probably not as competitive as we thought they were. I didn't expect to hear comments like that a few years ago, but they're pretty bloodthirsty now when they go out to the practice field.
I think the comments just didn't happen a few years ago.
The fights were very
unfortunate a few years ago. There were injuries in Notre Dame's football team in the last 3 years prior to this because of fights on the football field. Very, very bad ones. Two very, very bad ones. And they were because the melees got out of hand, and they were not Flanagan and Snead going at it and getting broken up. I mean, so that's the way it's evolved. Like, that's evolved for sure. It's not like it's always been kumbaya and all of a sudden let's start fighting. I mean, there was huge fights. And two careers were hurt by those fights. We are well aware of these. But it's evolved to the point where you let them. I mean, clearly there's an issue. And if they're going to fight, that's fine. Break up the fight. The two of them can fight. They can break it up, right? They're wearing pads. Once that helmet came off, everybody broke it up. You see that? Yeah. It's like, get away from them, man.
obviously Lou Holtz was an old school tough guy, but you know, Chris Zorich was getting his butt kicked out of practice on a regular basis because he was taken away from the practice time or whatever with the scuffle. So things have changed, and I agree. I mean, I think Marcus Freeman's a lot more comfortable embracing that whole notion that, we get after it in practice, and we're proud of it.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. Not everything has to be Bloody Tuesday, because you could do a lot of Bloody Tuesdays in the spring, probably, and then for a week in August, and then it everything. Remember, you're planning 16 games, you're planning 15 games, whatever that schedule is for. They can't be tested that hard all the time.
JB, has that whole thing kind of evolved since year one for Freeman from your perspective?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's maturity of the coach and the maturity of the program. And again, I do think it's the trust and continuity. This is all three guys at the coordinator spots back together. That's been such a rarity for Marcus Freeman during this time. Plus, it's the only time it's been all three of those guys back and your star quarterback to return. So, yeah, I think that's a significant part of the evolution of the program. But again, yeah, there's I don't want to say there's structure to the scuffles. There's just sort of an awareness to them.
He did even say, like, it's okay when two guys fight. He's like, you better don't get past that, because then it gets hard to control. I mean, that's
We move on to question number four from Memphis Phil. Who's someone you're looking to see in the spring game that you either didn't see much from or didn't get a good look at in the jersey scrimmage? Tim.
I got a little bit of a look, and that's why I want to see more of him. Jaden Sanders.
There you go.
Jaden Sanders is a aggressive guy who's playing backup nickel, and I want to see him play some nickel and some corner, because I still think he can challenge people. I don't think you come over from Michigan as a freshman who started and played plenty if you're not looking for 400 snaps, and to let people know there's probably 800 snaps as a corner out there. So I think Jaden Sanders is a guy a lot of people will enjoy watching, because he's also not rookie. He's already played some football.
His frame, he's pretty too, as the coaches like to say. Like, he is so long and just has this incredible wingspan and has this presence about him. So that's a great one there, Tio. I'm going to go with one of the veteran most guys on the defense, but because of the role he's now playing, I'm going to say Christian Gray. Like, we saw Christian Gray make a goal line play to break up a pass last week in the ones versus ones, and he broke up a CJ Carr pass. Can he do it in more space? Can he show some consistency at the nickel position. And so for me, I'm taking Christian Gray.
I mean, I definitely say Keon Keeley is, is a guy that we need. We want to see more of what he can do. We want to see the fight and the effort that for a couple plays last week that I didn't think I saw. I'm going to say Elijah Hughes, because suddenly that competition at tackle with Teon Gray and Francis Brew in the middle, where does Elijah Hughes fit in? I think he fits in nicely. He came in very strong. It came on very strong at the end of last season. He's bigger now. I think he's up to 295, which I think is a pretty good number for him. I just want to see what he can do. And then, you mentioned earlier Tim Aiden Pouncey. I was looking at the defense, and I don't think I really saw him, so I'm going to have to zero in on him a little bit more.
Jasper, that happens, though, just for people listening.
Yeah, it just does. I mean, there's just too much to watch sometimes. But Jasper Scaife punting outside, I really want to see that, because I think it can be pretty majestic and pretty magnificent. And then two freshman defenders, one that flashed in a good way, one that didn't flash necessarily in a good way because he was isolated on a receiver, and that was Chaz Smith, who didn't. He ended up losing a guy in coverage. But Thomas Davis, I thought he came up and filled one time. And it's in any of these settings, it's very difficult to see all the guys that you want to see. But those are some of the guys. And I'll throw in one in for Sampson, because he talked about James Flanagan. He didn't see much from him last week. Let's see if James Flanagan can get involved in the passing game a little bit more. We know he can block. Let's see if he can get involved in the passing game a little bit more.
Our next question from Dr. Parnell 42. This week, Tim O'Malley shared in a thread on the message board which places have the best pizza around South Bend area for visitors. If Priester, Sampson, John Bryce, and Drew had to pick, where would they go for pizza in the South Bend area? We'll have Drew chime in on instant analysis. I have Sampson's choice. John Bryce, go to it.
Is this question number 6? Okay.
I'm sorry. You're going to go to it anyway. Yeah, this is 5, yes.
All right, that's all right. I'm going in the South Bend area for traditional style pizza, Rocco's. If you want Chicago style pizza, I'm a Chicago style pizza fan. In the South Bend area, I'm going to Front Street Pizza in Niles, Michigan. Super underrated spot. I know some other people on campus who love it, and they've got some great appetizers. It's a cool little spot if you go there, but it's a great spot to just get your pizza to go, allow the standard 40 to 45 minutes. But Rocco's for the traditional thinner crust, almost New York style, and absolutely Front Street for some Chicago deep dish style.
I think for me, just pure taste, and again, I'm not taste bud police, but I've always loved Barnaby's. There's a couple of those in South Bend, Mishawaka. I think those are good, but for the full Notre Dame experience, don't you have to go to Rocco's? I mean, I think that's just dripping in Notre Dame-ness through the years. I like the atmosphere in Rocco's, but I like their pizza too. But I think Barnaby's is something truly unique to this area.
Pete Sampson asked if Goshen counted. I said yes, because Rick Meyer's from Goshen, so why not? Venturi Pizza. He called it the Jeremiah love of pizza. Yeah.
That's unfair. That's too far away. Like, Front Street Pizza is like 12 miles from campus. Venturi is too far.
Closer in Niles.
Illegal procedure.
I had a feeling someone's going to be mad. Closer in Niles is Milano's Pizza. And I know Annie Davis 2, who have seen walking out of that pizza place at the same time as me getting it. He would agree with me. Milano's Pizza is the best pizza for the best price in the area. Barnaby St. Louis is an icon, and also my favorite atmosphere is Barnaby St. Louis, that dark booths, everything. I love that spot. And then I was very sad when my daughter Charlotte's volleyball ended at Elkhart High School, because she used to do 2 hours there practicing on Friday nights when she was 11, and I would go to Antonia's Italian Restaurant, Tim Priester, and eat pizza.
So that's good.
Yeah, now I have no excuse. It's kind of far away, but that was good.
The move at Rocco's on the weekend when they have lasagna is to get the lasagna and then in a side cup of Alfredo sauce to go over the beet lasagna, and you can thank me and or send gift certificates to me later.
Our next question, actually number 6 for John Bryce's accounting purposes, is Terry Benedict. The term nickel in football was originally named because it was the 5th best defensive back on the field. Where would you rank it in terms of the game today?
You mean in terms of the value of that position on the field?
Yep. Let's leave quarterback out of it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know, because I don't think – I still think a defensive end has a chance to impact more plays on a regular basis. I still think a defensive tackle can be so disruptive. He can do so much for you that will make your nickel's job easier. And I'm still going to take a linebacker over a great nickel. Great linebacker, I'm taking over a great nickel and a great corner like Leonard Moore.
I think JB cut out there on the road.
I am not taking, just to respond, I'm not taking a linebacker over a great nickel. I'm taking a great nickel. I think that it's a linebacker.
Really?
Yeah, because he's playing linebacker now, and he can impact absolutely everything the entire game. Like when you go back to the Clemson, when Clemson had a true defense that Notre Dame couldn't handle in 18 and 20. I go nickel over linebacker.
You just have to be so quick twitch to play nickel. You can't get beat off the snap of the ball. You're done. You're done immediately. And I mentioned, I think, in the first segment about, you know, a cover corner. You got a little bit of chance to adjust to the route. Although that's, I mean, you're in wide open spaces, especially a field corner. You're in wide open spaces. That's really difficult. I don't know. I don't know exactly where. I love the question because Terry Benedict's right. The nickel used to be your fifth best defensive back, and it's very specialized now, to the point where we saw an example of Notre Dame recruiting at nickel with the commitment with John Gay. So, excellent question. You know, the skill sets required for what happens on the back end and what happens on the front end are so difficult. But I mean, we know every year that a coaching staff kind of goes through wringing their hands, trying to find a quality nickel. Notre Dame has gone into the transfer portal multiple times in order to find their nickel. So great question, and a very difficult position to play in its own right.
Think about this, guys. Notre Dame's defensive backs in a 17-year period, I'm sorry, their nickel in a 17-year period, went from Preston Jackson, to throw in there as the fifth guy, to Kyle Hamilton, who was brought on to be the nickel in 2019. Isaiah Simmons is who I was trying to think of for Clemson. I feel like that guy, it just changes everything when you have that. So I'm saying a great one, you know, a great linebacker or a great nickel. That's kind of what I was saying. But when you go to Preston Jackson, Sergio Brown to Kyle Hamilton and recruiting nickels, I think we've developed that the nickel is a pretty important spot these days. You think I would compare Preston Jackson to Kyle Hamilton on this podcast, Tim Priester? Or was that?
Would be the last time those two names I mentioned in the same breath. All right, question number 7. Did you choose this because it's Irish Cubs fan?
Yeah, I kind of moved it to your question.
By the way, 8-game winning streak. Don't want to jinx it. They're playing this afternoon at Wrigley for a sweep of the Phillies. Great time to play the Mets and the Phillies when they're both playing awful. Thank you very much. Irish Cubs fan asked, from the end of the year to today, who's the most improved player on the team? Could it be CJ Carr, and what would that mean?
I mean, that's possible. That is possible. So it's not a ridiculous question, but no, I think there'll be more improvement. He was really good last year. I think CJ Carr could roll out this version of CJ Carr last year. Just kind of, if he just went from being a really good freshman to really good sophomore, he'd still be a great player. So you don't need to worry about that. Most improved player. I hope it's Gray. That'd be a big deal. But the most important player, I hope it is Bryce Young.
That's the one that's most important.
The current most improved player from last year, I'd say Faison looks fantastic out there.
Yeah,
he really Faison does. Looks like it's almost a number one, like a real number one.
Who do you have, JB?
He wasn't on Notre Dame's team last year, but he arrived in January. So on the defensive side of the ball, I'm going with Teon Gray. I'm very impressed with how he's redefined his body. I thought he flashed a couple of times last week. I talked about this somewhere else. It's like, he beat a double team on Saturday from Absher and Joe Otting. And, I mean, he beat it convincingly and astonishingly quick for a human being the size of his. Offensively, I'm going with Will Black. He's back at left tackle. That's not where they had him last fall. He acquitted himself overall very well last week. He was not perfect. He won't be perfect Saturday. But I'm going with those two trench warriors.
I don't know that I have the definitive guy that has improved the most because I don't think that we've necessarily seen the most or seen enough of that. But, and you're right, Tim, Christian Gray. But I mean, I've always felt like Christian Gray was a good cornerback with the understanding the corners get beat. If you don't expect corners to ever get beaten, then
if he can play like Jordan Clark did at nickel, Notre Dame's defense is going to be insane.
Oh, that would be, yeah, that would be great. They need Bryce Young, though, to really, really step up. And again, I would like to think that Sullivan Apser is going to be a much better offensive guard based upon, you know, the five starts that he had and then an entire offseason and a chance to, you know, really get settled in a little bit. Maybe some of these are kind of wishful thinking, but I saw some flashes from Armel Mukum. If he could be the fifth defensive tackle that could actually get some run on game day, I think that would be very beneficial because he's a big guy that gets off the football pretty quickly. He's got to be assignment correct, but that would be a real important one because I think Chris Burgess's time is 2027.
Yeah,
it's not 2026.
I kind of agree with you. I think he has to grow into that frame that he has added to. Most guys that do that do have to grow into the frame, and I think they become August stars. Because he's going to look huge in August again. He'll probably have added 3 months of growing into the, well, he will have added 3 months of growing into the frame. And we're going to see him flash in practice number one, and it's going to be written about. And then you're going to be wondering why Chris Burgess is the sixth defensive tackle, because he's 1 year away from being the second defensive tackle or third defensive tackle. I think that's just the natural order of things. It even happened to Traore. But that's my Iwatade guy. You know, Traore walked out there his freshman year, like, well, that guy's going to be really good. You had to wait a little bit. It just, the way it works. Next question from JRP3. Speaking of guys that could improve from last year, what should be our expectations for Quincy Porter? His prep pedigree is obvious. We saw last year Carr has great touch for those 50-50 balls, deep balls in general, which should fit in nicely with Porter as the bigger body guy. Also, Porter's competition is a player in Micah Gilbert, who is not yet established as a returning starter. On the other hand, he's going to have to start summer ball effectively with zero chemistry with CJ Carr.
It's a great question. I think we all have the same curiosity about what Quincy Porter is going to bring to the equation. He brings length that nobody else on the team has at the wide receiver position. You know, I'm high on Micah Gilbert. I think it's Micah Gilbert's time. It definitely would have been his time without, you know, Porter competing with him. But you'd like to see a nice tandem there. You know, the ability to have a tandem at the X, Y, and Z is you know, important. And, or I should not, Y, that's tight end. W is what I mean. But it would be great if they could just form a tandem and they each caught 20-some passes. That way they'd stay fresh. Whoever came in would be a threat. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see how the football is distributed by CJ Carr. Tim, you brought up about Jordan Faison being a number one. In terms of passes caught last year, he was a number one, and you're right. He played like a number one last week. I think Mylon Graham probably has more overall physical tools, a little bit more length, getting away from Quincy Porter. JB, I'm interested to hear what you think and what you know about Quincy Porter and his progress and what the expectations are for him this fall.
Yeah, I mean, look, what made Quincy Porter a five-star prospect coming out of high school was his ability to get those jump balls, was how he went to some camps and shined, quote-unquote, mossing dudes in these camp settings. Unfortunately, he hasn't been able to stay healthy, not at Ohio State, and he's obviously not a part of spring practice this year for Notre Dame. So until I see it from him, I'm going to remain a little skeptical, even though he has that toolbox. I'm incredibly bullish on Mylon Graham, as I think I've established in recent weeks. And then Gilbert has had a nice spring. Jordan Faison, I think, will probably be a team captain and probably will lead the team in receptions. Great house, as Pete said last week. You believe you know he can do it, but you want to see him absolutely 100% healthy when August rolls around and they begin preseason camp. And then can Cam Williams take that next step? You know, Cam Williams has a chance to make it even harder for Quincy Porter to get on the field, because Cam Williams also is a bigger frame who's had, by all accounts, a very productive spring. So he's not going to back down now that he's come as close as he's legitimately ever come to being a real factor in the rotation for Notre Dame.
I'd say a realistic expectation for Quincy Porter is 30 catches and 5 touchdowns.
And you think that's realistic?
Yeah. I think he could be the starting. I think he could be the starting W because he could beat out Micah Gilbert, and they don't rotate as much as people think that they're going to do.
Well, I know they haven't. I'm just saying that would be a nice luxury to have.
But I just think he can beat up. I think he could be the starting W receiver, and they would be one of the three main receivers. Like
you already owe me a lunch, a trolling lunch. For trying to punk me on text message this week, which is another story altogether. I'll bet you a lunch. I'll take the under on 30 catches and 5 touchdowns.
As long as I'm talking realistic expectations. So as long as Quincy Porter is healthy going to camp and everything's fine and he's ready to roll, I think he'll win the W job.
Well, all right. Then if he's healthy going into camp on August 1st, then the bet for lunch is over under 30 catches and 5 touchdowns. Okay. Yeah. I'm in.
I think we named every receiver on the roster as opposed to look at the guys that are going to probably start and play. And that's one way of looking at this question is we just named everybody. Like, they're not all going to – like, we're not getting – they're not – you're not going to play 4 Ws. There's no way they're going to get to that. It's just he's on the roster like Cam Williams. If 2 guys get hurt, Cam Williams will be the backup W.
I
I'm serious. Well,
yeah, because Fitzgerald's probably in the starting
lineup.
That's what
I mean. If 2 guys get hurt, Cam Williams is the backup W.
I hear what you're saying, and I do think that Cam Williams has made a strong move, but I don't think it's going to be strong enough to get past the 3 guys that we're talking about.
Yeah,
I'm just saying 30 catches and 5 tutties is a big number in my
five touchdowns is a big number, but there's also not running for 38 touchdowns this year. But the 2 best running backs in the world, I mean, that's a huge thing too. They're going to get 20. Yeah. CJ's throwing a record number.
He's throwing a lot. Right. He's going to add 1,000 yards of passing.
Yes.
Compared to his 2,700. You know, he only threw 24 passes a game last year.
Yeah. Well, they did have the 2 best running backs they've had.
I understand.
3 best in the last 10 years.
You do what you got
to
do.
Yeah. I'd hand it off to those guys, too. I'd throw it to those guys, too. Final question from Alexandra Stock Up. When the 2026 football season ends, who will rank as the 3rd best player on the 2026 football team? And, John Bryce, you cannot mention a wide receiver.
Don't worry. The 3rd best anywhere on the roster at the end of 2026. So we're obviously going with C.J. Carr and Leonard Moore, 1 and 2. I guess I'm going to go with Drake Bowen as number 3.
I think this is a great question because I think
great.
It really is. And I'm glad you chose it for last because I think it deserves being set apart from, you know, I agree, John. I mean, I think, you know, C.J. Carr and Leonard Moore consider the 2 best. And then after that, you know, a healthy Kingston Viliamuasa and a surging Tay Johnson, I think, make it real difficult to make that call. I'd probably lean towards Tay Johnson because he's healthy right now and KVA isn't. But then again, does Bubakar Traore break out and have 11 sacks, which we know that he's perfectly capable of doing, especially with the supporting cast, the surrounding cast that he has along the defensive line. And then you have Charlie Partridge as your defensive line coach, who's accustomed to having, you know, sacks across the board from tackles and defensive ends that he's coached. I think I love the question. I think Mylon Graham, I don't know about number 3, but I think Mylon Graham can be up there in the top 5. I am not supposed to mention wide receivers, right?
Can, but we just need 1 for the number 3. That's why it's hard.
I'm doing it again, right? I'm doing it again. I would say Tay Johnson. He would be my choice. I think he has All-American potential.
My choice is Traore because I think KVA will miss some games or not be KVA until midway through. And if I'm just going to be fair when we're ranking them, presuming you and I are like we're ranking these at the end of the year, I will probably penalize poor KVA for missing a few games. I mean, if Traore's great for 16. Well,
we're about ready to rank him, and we know that he's not going to be ready for the start of the season. Yeah. So
if he's great in 12 and Traore is great in 15 or 16, then I think that's a big difference. That'll so work. I'm going to go Traore because he would be in the NFL right now.
I was
injured.
I was.
Go ahead, JB.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say I was really tempted on a Don Shuler, to be honest with you. Like, my third was always going to be a defensive player, and the three I very quickly racked my brain to consider were Bubakar, Drake Bowen, and a Don Shuler.
Oh, that's a great point. We're going to add question 9B to this. You can't name a defensive player because most names are a defensive player here. We had Tay Johnson, KVA, Traore, and a Don Shuler. Who is a realistic number three? So he has to pass all those guys. Those guys finish 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know, that's what has to happen there. That's tough.
Nolan James.
I was going to say Aeneas Williams.
Yeah.
That's good.
God, three's too high. I was going to say, like, you're getting into an offensive lineman range here, but it's three's too high. I would. All right. It's such a good question. I can't answer it.
Well, it's so difficult to keep the ball in the hands of Faison, especially.
Yeah, Faison's my choice. I think Faison's my choice.
He could catch.
I don't think he'll be number three, though.
But. Carr will distribute the football, but Faison could catch 55 or 60 passes. Because a lot of that isn't downfield. That's just getting the football in his hands.
Yeah.
And he can get open underneath very, very easily.
He'll break tackles. He'll return a punt for a touchdown. He'll do something in the special teams game where Marty Biagi has him somewhere and he ends up on a kickoff, getting a touchdown or something like that. There's all these things that Faison can do.
Yeah, I would just like we took that over-under on Quincy Porter on the catches and touchdowns, like, to TP's point, like, I'd be pretty stunned if Faison stays healthy all year. I'll be frankly stunned if he doesn't have more than 60 catches. I really will. Like, I think what we've seen, he had, 7, 8, 9 last Saturday. There was another day right before that. He had 7 catches in practice, and I know that's just practice. But, yeah, I think Faison volume this year is going to be intense. And as we get ready to wrap up, T.O., I just want to say, you, in your taskmaster role, you preordained that I would answer questions 3, 6, 9. So I appreciate you letting me fill the role of Little John and the East Side Boys today.
Nice. The little fly in the ointment, if JB left, he'll have to hear it later, is still my guy. If Aeneas Williams is third in receiving, he throws off all these catches. Because if he's a guy they throw to like Darius Walker, where he's catching 38 passes or something, and that's very possible if he's playing the whole time, just as part of the offense. Yeah, the number distribution receiver will be fun this year. I just think they throw more because CJ Carr can throw it in the end zone a lot easier.
Side bets. You set it up, T.O.
There's plenty of side bets for this one. Last year's side bets was, will Jeremiah Love get 20 touchdowns and stuff like that? He was just he and Jadarian Price were. You know, to be fair, Price was even better than we thought he was going to be last year. We don't give Price enough love, I think, for how good he was. That was fun. Blue Gold Game will be almost as fun as this podcast was. And on Monday, we will have another podcast dedicated to the Blue Gold Game. We'll also have an instant analysis pregame and postgame this Saturday. Until then, for Tim Priester, John Bryce, who bounced, Jack Freeman behind the camera, I am Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.